Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we visit with Kevin Chesso, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He coordinates the Master Gardener Volunteer Program for that Tri-County area. He also works with the UW-Madison Spooner Experiment Station. Talk with him about the research that goes on there. We'll take your gardening questions as well, of course, and love to hear from you. Become part of our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Kevin Chesso joins us by phone. Kevin, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, of course, Larry. It's always a pleasure. And I'm doing this from my office here at the Spooner Ag Research Station. So I hope this works out well.
You know, when I first started my first year working at the station, one of my jobs was to drive to Spooner from Madison to the Spooner Sheep Day.
No kidding. Wow. Well, that was one of our longest standing programs. We went 64 years with that program, and unfortunately, I won't go into all the details, but that program was ended in 2016. So, yeah, the sheep are gone, and that all we have now is all the wonderful stories and history and all, of course, the research that came from that. But, yeah, we're happy. I'm very happy to be here and work closely with the research station staff here. So you've been here, so you know we're a little further north than a lot of parts of the state, but that's one of our reasons to be here.
Yeah, and okay, there aren't sheep there anymore, but there's a lot more going on. So talk about what kinds of work does go on there.
Sure. But I just want to preference this first, Larry. You know, and I'm glad you mentioned that you've been here. But UW-Madison, through their College of Ag and Life Sciences, has a Department of Agriculture Research stations. So there are a number of these facilities across the state that UW-Madison operates, and Spooner is just one of about 12 different ones. And I'm sure you've been to some of the other ones
that are
across the state. So we're one of many properties that the research station or Madison operates. So we're a relatively small potatoes, no pun intended there, but the big one that I think most people are maybe have heard of is the one that's just north of Madison in Arlington.
Yeah.
But there's several others. But here at Spooner, we're focusing currently on, more of the agronomy and crop research. That's still here, and it's always been here. And we have a pretty good history with some of our crop research from many, many years ago. And we're continuing to work on the agronomy side, doing corn, soybeans, small grains, other crops that are important to this part of the state. And the thing that I'm excited about, as much as I hated to see the dairy sheep project go away, we are bringing on some new researchers out of UW-Madison and new collaborations and partnerships. And one of those would be to explore and expand some of our horticulture research. And I think you've talked to Julie Dawson.
Yes.
With her efforts in what she's calling the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative. So we're very fortunate that we brought that project up to Spooner, a full-fledged, we call it full-blown research trial. It involves about 1 acre of land. It's all managed organically here at the research station, and it's pretty involved as far as the number of crops, and it's set up to be a full research protocol using, the statistical methods, a complete, block design, replicated, and all the bells and whistles to make it statistically significant. So the data that we collect from that trial, does have that statistical rigor that feeds into, the research that so many UW-Madison staff and faculty are involved with. So that's one of the projects that came more recently. And there's other researchers from Madison that are involved in that as well. So that's just one highlighted project. But like I said, there's other things that we've incorporated here. Kernza, which is called perennial wheatgrass. It's one of the few grain crops that's considered a perennial. So unlike a lot of our other grain crops like corn, soybeans, and even wheat, that's an annual. And there's obviously advantages to that. But this perennial wheatgrass is a new up-and-coming potential crop for Wisconsin. So that's another reason we have these research stations, so that we can take some of that risk and do some of the demonstration plantings and all the other research that has questions that come with growing new crops. So the Kernza plot is just getting established. So that's something new and exciting. We also have hazelnut, and yeah, that project has been going here for a number of years, and that's early in the stages of that commercial industry. It's called the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Initiative, and the idea here is that, you know, it's a big project that has a lot of tough nuts to crack. We have those plants here as well, and again, that's the whole role of the research stations, is to provide the outdoor laboratories so that researchers can grow plants in in the ground, in all different climates and environments. And you know, one of our fortes here at Spooner is, you know, we're the furthest north research station in Wisconsin for UW-Madison. You know, we have short growing season, typically a little more sandy soil, although we do manage crops on a silt loam site a few miles south of Spooner, so we can bring that into the mix. But Bob Tomish, if you remember Bob.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He loved to come to Spooner, and he would always bring plant materials up here, and we'd plant those in our teaching and display garden. And he'd say, well, take it to Spooner and see if we can kill it. that's just another tongue-in-cheek reason to do some of this stuff is, you know, sometimes we just don't know how plants are going to perform when you move them into different environments. And I think that's the whole premise behind the research station model. And, Spooner is the oldest research station of all of the research stations in the state. In 1909, this property was established so that researchers from UW-Madison could, you know, use this location to get data and experience things that you couldn't do right outside of Madison or on, you know, the Madison campus proper. So, yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is cool, and I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to work beside researchers and the station staff here. As you know, I work with the Division of Extension. I do the outreach and work with local clients and growers and gardeners and farmers. But the research station is managed by Phil Holman, and so he's the one that works more directly with the researchers and doing all the protocols and getting the plots established. And we collect all kinds of data ourselves here at the research station and send it down to the researchers in Madison. That doesn't happen at all the research stations. We do have graduate students and other staff that come here during the growing season, you know, to collect that data. But we do a lion's share of that here ourselves with our staff, because it is a ways from Madison, and we can do a lot of that service and data collection for them.
Sure.
So I'm not really involved with that directly, but I certainly have a really good idea of all the different projects that go on. And I especially enjoy working with Julie and Ruth Ginger, who's got her potato project here. And I really like to take the byproducts of that research. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
data. And all that data, of course, gets fed down to Madison. And the researchers take that, and they've got their statisticians and their graduate students. And you know how that works, Larry.
Yeah.
that are crunching the numbers. But what we're left with, and this would be the byproduct of the research, and that's the primary reason to have the research is for the data. But on the horticulture side, we have organically managed produce that once they're done collecting their data and taking their subsamples and doing what they need to for their research, we're left with all this organic food.
Right? Which is great.
Yes, right. So that's where I come in, and I really look at that food, you know, those individual unique varieties and different types as teachable moments that we can have conversations with all kinds of different folks in our communities about local foods, you know, a little bit on the research side. I mean, we can't get too deep into that for the average person, but at least we acknowledge that, you know, we're here, we're doing this work in hopes of improving our food system, both on the commodity side with our grains and corn and soybeans and those things, and we got to have those. But at the same time, you know, as gardeners and market gardeners and farmer market vendors and restaurants and all the people that enjoy fresh seasonal, I got to put that caveat on there.
Sure.
Because, you know, we can't grow things year-round in Wisconsin, but, boy, during the growing season, we can sure do a lot of interesting things. So,
yeah, you do a lot. You spend a lot of your time there, if I'm not mistaken, in the teaching and display garden.
Yeah, that's, again, I'm so blessed in the fact that my office and I have access to the property here as an extension staff, and that's not very common. I mean, I've got lots of colleagues across the state that do awesome work just like I am, but, you know, they don't have the research station property and all the equipment and whatnot right outside their office door, so to speak. So, yes, I've developed an outdoor classroom. We call it our teaching and display garden, and that's been going for onwards of 20 years. And that's open to the public, and it's really focused on demonstration and hands-on gardening activities and workshops and all the things that you can do with an outdoor classroom, just like, you know, school gardens and other community gardens, and some of my colleagues also manage, you know, gardens like that at their sites. But there's nothing like being outside doing hands-on teaching, and that's why we call it a teaching and display garden. So I've been, again, very fortunate to have access to that, and you've talked about it in the past. We have our field days and stuff for that outreach, but now I get to also talk about some of the organic vegetable variety trialing and projects we've been doing with our organically managed research trials. And that's just another very unique opportunity to have that right here on the property and invite people in. And, yeah, it's kind of exciting. As you know, research requires a lot of work. There's a lot of maintenance and management just in keeping the plants healthy. And then all the data that needs to be collected as well. So,
a lot going on there. What were some of the most successful plants you had from last year's garden?
Oh, boy. Yeah, this is a tough question to answer because, you know, I'm not as intimately involved in, you know, harvesting and viewing the plant materials that we grow. Julie Dawson has done a really nice job of putting a lot of that information on her website. So I would encourage listeners to go to the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative website, and she's got a number of tabs on her website, and in there are research results. And what I like about the way Julie has done this is not only are they using unnamed varieties that plant breeders are still trying to introduce to the gardening public, but they've also selected out some of the better commercially available ones that you can find in seed catalogs. You know, the big and small and organic and heirloom, some hybrids. And she's got all that kind of listed on her website. So there are some familiar names that I've seen in the catalogs and that we've grown in our teaching and display garden. And I tell you, you garden enough, you do find varieties that are better suited for your specific location.
And oh, absolutely.
That's one of the things I like about being involved with research. It doesn't have to be real highfalutin and you know, the lab coat scientist kind of approach. You can do this in your backyards and just do real simple comparisons. Maybe you're not collecting a lot of rigorous data, but, you know, just try different varieties side by side and see how they do. And that's one of the things that we're trying to remind, you know, gardeners and farmers about is that, you know, you sometimes have to try some of this stuff on your own, you know, property, on your own farm, and see how it does, and then compare that to some of the data that we have collected, maybe, you know, in a larger way across the state on multiple sites, and then you kind of have to, you know, kind of run that all through the critical thinking process and say, I think this is a variety that works best for me, and I'm going to give it a try. So
there you go.
And I really can't say which ones are ideal. There's a lot of really unique varieties out there that we sometimes forget about.
Kevin Chesso, our guest today, he's the Ag Development Educator at UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Talking with him on Garden Talk. If you have some questions for him, I hope you'll join in. Could be about plants, could be about the station, the Spooner Station. Join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Dave Potratz, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Chesso, who works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties at the Ag Development. He's the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison. It's great to have him with us today. We've been talking quite a bit about the Spooner Station and the research going on there and some of the work, but he's here to answer some of your other gardening questions, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Chris in Adams will give you a chance now. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I promised Jill I'd be polite. Your guest said that you can't grow things in Wisconsin in the wintertime. That's like patently untrue. If you set yourself up with the right kind of circumstance, you can grow pretty much anything over winter, and I'm sitting here in my sunroom looking at my fresh herbs that are in the window, and I don't really even have this setup completed as much as it needs to be, but you can do all kinds of things. Like you can bury a greenhouse and provide it with enough Southside solar and enough solar panels so that you don't really have to pump any extra energy into it. And you can grow pretty much anything year round. People are growing shrimp in Wisconsin, for crying out loud. I mean, it's using a lot of energy because they have to heat it, but you can. It's possible to do that, and I think that we should discuss that. You can grow your own organic vegetables in Wisconsin in the wintertime.
There you go, Chris. Well, Kevin, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, Chris, I certainly get your point, and I guess I was thinking more big picture, you know, the outside kind of commercial plot garden, you know, in the soil gardening that we do, obviously, in the growing season. But you are absolutely correct in acknowledging that there is all kinds of different creative ways that we can grow any number of plants inside. You know, we've been doing it for a long, long time from, you know, just people who like to enjoy houseplants. And there's that whole concept of how do you grow plants in pots. But you can do all kinds of things to extend that growing season, even outside with some of our high tunnels and unheated or creatively heated greenhouses, two full-blown greenhouses with, you know, environmental controls and aquaponics, hydroponics, you name it. So you're right. I mean, there's just a matter of how much effort and time and energy and creativity we want to put into growing produce once Mother Nature, you know, sends that killing frost. In fact, I had some potted plants outside that were, you know, getting nipped by frost, and I decided, you know, I'm going to do my part and bring those inside, and I'm going to give it a try. Light levels are much lower, and you got to be set up to, you know, accommodate the plant, but it can be done. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks very much for calling, Chris. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Rod had called to ask if you're interested or if you're seeing the effects of climate change in the Spooner area.
Well, you know, again, not to get too deep in the weeds on this whole topic, but I guess from my experience, I've been here at the research station for, this is my 21st season, and we are an official weather station. And one of the things that we obviously track are, you know, temperature highs and lows. And the thing that I've noticed, not so much about, you know, again, this is a lot of averages and this and that that kind of got to be thrown into the conversation here, but our average killing frost dates have definitely, when you look at the 30-year averages, we have a slightly longer growing season than we did 20 years ago. Now, you know, in the big picture, you know, as in hundreds or thousands of years, is that significant? I'm not going to go there, but I will say that we have seen longer falls, and that means we might be able to grow slightly longer varieties. But at the end of the day, you still, it's not always about the averages, it's about when those temperatures arrive, if you've got drought that happens right during pollination. You know, there's other weather factors that really play into our success in growing plants. But in general, I would say that from a frost-free period, we do have a little bit longer growing season than our statistics and our data shows us from, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, so that, you know, it just slowly changes. But in general, we're still zone 3B, 3A, argue one way or the other, and we got to deal with that.
There you go. Jeff in Chippewa Falls is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I have a question. When I had read in an organic supplies catalog that red mulch is best for raising tomatoes, especially in an organic situation. And I was wondering if that was correct and if that also applies to pepper plants.
Yeah, I'm not intimately familiar with the research. I know it's been done, and these are those IR reflective kind of plastic mulches. So you get, you know, certain colors, and when the sunlight hits on it, it reflects back different wavelengths back up to the plants. And, of course, you know, plants respond differently to some of those wavelengths. And there has been some research that's shown that some of these IR fabrics do seem to have improved performance for our plants. You know, maybe it's mostly related to the yield. But I would say, you know, just like any new concept, or if you want to try something, you know, just do your research, and you know, you can do a lot of it online. You just got to be careful on the sources. I'm always encouraging people to go to university, you know, .edu sites or .org, and just, you know, do a general search on some of these concepts. And you know, if you feel that this red mulch is something that seems to have some pretty good references for, you know, being advantageous, I would say go ahead and give it a try. Our challenge is you've got to do this over multiple years and, you know, different points so that you can get a good feeling whether or not that's something you want to continue to do or not. But, you know, that old saying, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Go ahead, you know, give it a try. And like I said, I think there are some valid research to indicate that these plastic mulches work. Some will argue, well, they're plastic, therefore, is that really organic? You know, and again, there's where those philosophical differences come into play. And, you know, if you're doing it on a small scale and it's not a lot of plastic, it might not be a very big deal at all.
All right, Jeff, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, you know, just as an aside, gardeners are experimenters anyway. I'd experiment with that just to see how it would work, you know?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Why
not? Chris in Washburn County, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I live in rural Washburn County, and I'm barely a gardener. I just finally grew some tomatoes last year. However, driving by all these different farm fields, wondering what's going on, how they do stuff, we were made aware of a farmer-led watershed council, and I know that the Extension Service in Washburn County partnered with other organizations, and my husband and I attended a very interesting program, met several farmers who are into regenerative farming, which was all new to me. And I really appreciated it, meeting the farmers that we drive by all the time, met some very local ones. And how does your guest, are they trying to promote this? I know they did a great job partnering with different organizations, and specifically about this regenerative farming, which I think is just fascinating. And is this a growing movement? I hope. I just think it's just fascinating, and not being a gardener myself. So okay. What's your guest's thoughts on that and how the farmers are doing and promoting this among us average sure. citizens up here?
So the and maybe you could start, Kevin, by talking about what is regenerative farming.
Well, Chris, first of all, thank you so much for you know, this bringing this up and for attending that that event. And I'm sure I was in the audience somewhere or behind the scenes doing it, because I've certainly been involved with that farmer-led council effort. But to get to your question, Larry, on regenerative agriculture, and you know, as the you know, as that term implies, it's kind of indicating that, you know, maybe we could do things a little better, a little differently, to, you know, improve the soil and improve our farming practices. Again, not that we want to, you know, say it's all bad, but that term is been it's kind of the new sustainable agriculture, or, you know, the term of the, I don't know, say the day or the decade or whatnot, but basically that concept is trying to get people to think about ways we can add to the soil and make improvements, protect it, not just maintain it, but improve the soil condition and the whole ecology that comes with growing plants and agriculture in general. So that might involve, you know, it doesn't have to be organic. It's not necessarily saying it's an organic philosophy, but, you know, we're using strategies and best management practices to be a little more intentional about improving. And, you know, that could be cover crops. That's a big part of this regenerative agriculture. It might be trying to think of ways to, you know, capture runoff so that it doesn't leave the field. It might be using livestock in a more deliberate way to harvest some of the cover crops, multi-species, diversity. Again, just how can we think about our current system and make it better? And there's obviously some barriers there to getting, you know, changing habits to farm differently or even garden. And you know, Larry, I'm a huge fan of composting and adding organic matter to your soils and, you know, all the things that help, you know, keep the soil healthy. And we can take some of those same concepts and think about them, you know, on a larger scale. And that's where that regenerative agriculture movement, and there's a few, I would say, poster farmer celebrities that are popping up. I don't know if anybody knows about, like, Joel Salatin, Salad Bar Beef. He wrote a book. You know, it's just like, oh, you write a book and all of a sudden you become, you know, a celebrity. But there is a new wave of farmers out there that are kind of promoting this regenerative agriculture and doing a really good job of getting other farmers to think about how they might try this on their own farm. It's very unique.
Yeah.
It's like gardening, you know. That's kind of, you know, where we're at with that. And who knows? I mean, I hope we are continuing this conversation 5-10 years from now and building off of some of these concepts. But you know how it is. Change takes time, and not everybody is in the same position to do that. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Chris.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Let's go to Darcy in Turtle Lake. Hi, Darcy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This year I brought in my Brussels sprouts because one was like 4 feet tall, and my kale, my Swiss chard, my chives, and celery because I just couldn't see. I didn't want it to die. And I put lights up. It's in a south-facing patio window. So when it doesn't get the light from outside, then I turn on the other lights, the LEDs and the white lights and the full spectrum. and I think they're doing pretty good.
Well, and Turtle Lake is pretty far north.
Well, I used to live in Madison, and it's a different zone. It's 4A up here, so that limits me. But I still experiment, so people can always try anything they want to try, is what I think.
Yeah.
Right, and again, you gotta think like a plant. I mean, if you're, you know, if your natural habitat or you evolved out, you know, outside, you know, and there are certain crops, like you mentioned, those coal crops that are much more cold tolerant, you know, those are the ones that would probably be most suited to, you know, being brought indoors because you're not going to have the temperature up to 75, 80 degrees for them to thrive. But where we often run short or have a challenge is in the light and the light intensity. And, yeah, you can put them in those south-facing windows, but, you know, you get these cloudy days, and as the sun changes angle, that intensity goes down. So that's when you have to supplement with, you know, what, right? And, you know, it doesn't have to be a specific grow light, but, you know, some kind of supplemental lighting. And how do you do that, you know, reasonable and, you know, cost-effectively? And, of course, there's the energy now that goes into providing that, you know, increased light intensity. So the LEDs are much cheaper to run now than, you know, even the fluorescent. So, yeah, just keep trying to make sure those plants get adequate light. And now that they're inside, we got to water them and can't forget about them. You know, when they're outside, you know, there's a little more buffer in the system there, and but there's no pests, right?
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to have a deer coming in and nibbling on those plants. So yeah, there's real advantages to doing that. And like you, I just hate to see, you know, those little plants or those well-established plants just, you know, kind of freezing, and then they're done and only destined for the compost pile, I suppose. But, yeah, good for you.
And thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. You know, here we are. It's middle of November. Anything that gardeners can be doing in their gardens right now?
Oh, well, you know, again, there's Mother Nature. I'm looking out my window right now, Larry, and we had a light dusting of snow, an inch or so that had fallen, and now it's warmed up, and now you can see the leaves and bare ground again. But that's not maybe the case downstate where they've gotten a little more snow. So you always have to make adjustments, and Mother Nature is your partner in all this. But, you know, I still like to take advantage of this time of year to do whatever fall cleanup we can still do. You know, and that's any number of activities that, you know, you might need to still get your plants ready for winter. You know, that's where mulching around maybe some tender perennials and providing a little more insulation with some kind of mulch might be appropriate. Or, you know, raking leaves and getting leaves up off the lawns. So that's a very common fall activity. And again, getting back to that whole, you know, let's take advantage of all that free organic matter that's in our yards and on our properties, and leaves and even pine needles. You know, once they're composted for 6-8 weeks or over the winter, come next spring, June, July, you've got this wonderful mulch to use around your plants for weed control and water maintenance and all those things that mulches do for us, and they build the soil. So raking leaves and putting them in some kind of a bin, you know, if you still have that activity to do, that would be something. Pruning, sometimes, you know, the fall is a good time to do that. Just depends on, you know, your interests and what you got to do. But, you know, we can prune out dead and dying and broken branches and do that kind of maintenance things. Why not do it now? It really isn't going to hurt the plant. Everything's dormant. So there's some pruning activities that you can do. And I guess just think about ways to prepare for next year and, you know, do whatever other tidying up needs to be done.
You know, I've had some questions about fruit trees and damage during the winter. Should they, if you've got a damaged tree, should you be removing the damage right away, or you want to wait a while, or what would you do?
Well, you know, there's all those it depends kinds of scenarios, but, you know, the first thing I always think about when there's, you know, a broken branch or something, you know, is there a safety concern if it's going to be, you know, in the way, and depends on the size of it and all those kind of things. So, you know, there might be an immediate concern to get something cleaned up or removed. But if not, you know, you can do a rough pruning and just get the branches out of there. But really, from a plant standpoint, we like to prune when, you know, and this is on woody plants, when they're dormant. So that would be this time of year all the way through, you know, March and even into April. So when we take out those branches, we just got to be aware of our pruning cuts and how that cut is made. We don't like to leave stumps or nubbins. We like to cut back to a branch union or collar. And certainly we're not advocating we put pruning sealant on those. Let the, you know, wound naturally dry up and it'll seal up eventually. So, yeah, pruning can be a real challenge, again, depending on, you know, how involved we want to get. But, you know, those maintenance kind of things of removing dead and dying branches certainly helps the tree not only aesthetically, but it gets rid of, you know, some of those open areas that might cause, you know, disease if it's left alone. If we cut it back to that stub, at least it has a chance to heal over.
Ellen in Lodi has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. How are you guys?
Great. Appreciate the call.
I am glad you're there to ask this question. I have three big potted mums that I bought this fall, and I have brought them inside and attempts to keep them alive over the winter and plant them in the spring. And I'm curious if I have them in a west window. It gets some east sun, mostly west, afternoon sun. And I have been keeping them moist. I'm curious if I should cut them down. The blooms are looking pretty faded.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
And just curious if I could hope to plant them in the spring.
I don't have a lot of personal experience, you know, with mums. Obviously, they're very popular fall plant because they do so well in the cool weather and they flower late in the year like this. And I get it, you know, you got this beautiful plant and you know it's going to be too cold to keep it outside. So it's like, well, what can we do to preserve it? And like you're indicating, keep it alive, alive and hopefully well enough that you can plant it out again next year. I guess, you know, you just got to keep in mind the plant's needs. And, you know, there is a dormancy period that it might need to go under, and I'm not sure how important that is, but, you know, as soon as you bring a plant inside, it's not going to be subject to any of those normal events that occur out, you know, when it's outside, like, you know, a dormant period with frost and cold temperatures. So I guess I don't have a good answer as far as specifically for mums. But just like all indoor plants, you know, you got to take into account its needs for water and nutrients. And if it looks like it's too dry, you water it. And as far as cutting back, I don't know. I guess I would have to do a little bit more research online to see what others suggest you do that. Maybe there's some other callers out there who know more about specifics on mums. But I don't see any reason why.
Typically, as my memory serves, you bring them indoors and keep them in a cool spot. And if you're trying to overwinter them and actually in a darker area, and then you just kind of keep them lightly watered.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of like bringing the geraniums into and bulbs. You know, you put them in some kind of sand or P peat moss and keep them moist, but they don't really actively grow. You know, but again, I'm not, as you know, Larry, I'm not a huge flower person, but I get it, and I know they have their place. I've just never really messed with those as far as overwintering. I stick with my herbs, and right now the lettuce and spinach I've got hanging in my window.
So, Ellen, stay listening. There may be somebody else calling in with their own ideas about this as well. We'll get to Norman and Wausau in just a second, but a reminder, our guest today, Kevin Schesso, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Schesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Great to have him along. Call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Norman in Wausau now. Hi, Norman. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Kevin about two perpetual problems we have every year. In the summertime, our Chinese cabbage are overrun with slugs. No matter how much slug bait I use, I put ashes around it. I try to find screen. I tried putting that grow cloth over it and down into the dirt to try to screen them out. Somehow, they still seem to get in. And the second problem they have both in the summertime and when I bring the plants inside in the fall, and then they get on my other plants as well, are aphids. And the problem with that is I can get rid of the aphids with a Promethean spray, but I kill some of my plants. So is there a safe way of doing that without, and then for the summer for those slugs?
Okay. Well, you've got two different pests here. One is actually not an insect but per se, and that would be the slugs. You know, it's in the mollusk family, so there isn't a lot of, you know, sprays, if you want to say it that way, or products that are going to work on slugs that would also maybe be useful on other insects like your aphids. So some of the strategies that you've talked about are ones that we often suggest because, you know, the slugs are going to be crawling on the ground and they they hide under debris or they're hanging out somewhere and then they come out typically at night to feed. So that's where, you know, there's any number of different things from, you know, making a little trap with a beer can half full of beer, empty, you know, or cut in half, laying in the soil. They crawl in there. Some people will deliberately put, like, bricks or boards near their garden so that the slugs might crawl under there. And then, you know, you flip over the boards, and there they are, and you can squish them. Diatomaceous earth, when they crawl across that, they might get cut up, and that might deter them. There are slug baits and different products used for slugs, and if you've tried those and they're not, you know, very successful, you know, maybe you've got a unique environment there that is, you know, really conducive to the slugs, and maybe you might consider trying a different location or trying some things in pots. You know, Chinese cabbage, you know, they can be kind of, I don't know, they're more tender. You can get different molds and wilts that happen with them as well. And, you know, maybe it's too wet where they are, and that's favoring the slugs.
I was thinking that, you know, we had kind of a wet year in a lot of the state. And, you know, I think slugs like it when it's wet.
Oh, yes, and they like that debris, you know. So, again, I don't know all the environmental conditions around your Chinese cabbage, but, you know, it might, you know, you might try a different approach to growing your cabbage, and maybe that's how you can avoid that concentrated area of the slugs. Or like Larry said, you know, it could be that it's just a conducive year to that. And these things have, you know, they're out there just like all of our other pests, so... In regards to the aphids, You know, the sprays that you mentioned, there's any number of them that work. A method that I like to use when I do have outbreaks, and, you know, they're too, you know, every year's different. If you get the right kind of weather conditions, those populations can explode, and it just requires a lot of scouting, a lot of hand, you know, work as far as looking underneath the leaves, making sure you don't have a big outbreak. You know, you can start with just trying to blast them off with water if that's an appropriate technique. Just dislodge them. You know, obviously it's not going to kill them, but it'll definitely give them something else to think about for a little while they find their way back on your plants. You know, downside of that is now you're wetting that leaf tissue, and maybe that's now conducive to other fungal diseases that might like that wet leaf tissue. You know, there's, you know, insecticidal soaps, those work as well too. You know, covering them, yeah, it depends on the plant. You said the aphids were on what plant?
Well, they're on the Chinese cabbage, believe it or not, and they're also on my lemon, my Meyer lemon plant inside, and the Meyer lemon got it from the Chinese cabbage that's only a couple feet away.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. When we bring in outdoor plants, we're also maybe bringing in outdoor pests. And Larry, I know you have a lemon tree.
I have a lime tree. I don't have a lemon yet. I'm going to get a lemon next spring. But I've limey. I haven't had any trouble with that sort of, you know, problem. And the lime tree has got lots of limes on it right now.
Oh, wonderful! Yeah. So you know, again, I would suggest just trying to use you know, try the insecticidal soaps. Those should work on the aphids, and you know, if you need to use something a little bit more on the, you know, the synthetic, you know, insecticide sprays, those are out there as well. Just read the instructions and understand. But you know, these aphids will, their populations can explode if you're not taking care of them. So that's where you got to be really on top of it, and just keep, you know, even rubbing the plant leaves and doing some killing with your fingers and with a towel or a napkin or whatever to, you know, get rid of some of that is better than nothing. So
yep.
You know, at some point, you should be able to get ahead of that, you know, population.
Brett in Menominee will give you a chance. Hi, Brett. Oh, we lost Brett. I think he had another comment about beer in the garden in a lid, a jar lid or something like that, and it does work pretty darn well as far as I know. Steve in Waupaca, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. My question is, and I've experimented a little bit with the hazelnut also from the National Arbor Day Society. I was wondering if transplanting hybrid hazelnuts or hazelnuts from other parts of the states has an effect on the native hazel brush that we have around, you know, in our woods, the Corollis and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's certainly something we got to, you know, be aware of anytime we're moving plant materials around and what might be the chance of those plant materials that are coming from different regions. Somehow cross-pollinating. I mean, that would be really the only way I could think of that, you know, happening kind of on its own without us really being intentional. And yeah, there's always that risk, you know, but my guess is that that would be relatively small, especially in our native, you know, woodlands and out in nature. I'm not familiar with the exact mechanism of how hazelnuts are pollinated, if they're self-pollinated or if they require cross-pollination. Again, that's every plant has got its unique, you know, mechanisms for pollination, and I'm not familiar with that with the hazelnut. I do know that there are hybrid hazelnuts that are being developed, as well as some of the natural selections that we find out in nature, and that's again part of that hazelnut initiative that we have here at the research station. They've planted over 300 selections. Most of those are just wild selections that they kind of gleaned by just walking around and looking for certain traits and saying, hey, this seems to be a really interesting, productive-looking selection. Let's put it in a plot and compare it side by side amongst a whole bunch of other ones. And then once you do that selection, then you can do the, you know, there's a number of different ways they can propagate those. Mostly it's through either tissue culture or cuttings. So you don't even need to have, you know, any kind of, you know, hybridization or seed production. It's just basic cloning. So,
yeah.
But it's a good question. It's, you know, it's always, you know, trying to think of those unintended consequences when we're moving plant materials around. And we certainly know what can happen when you do that.
Kevin Scheso, our guest today, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Scheso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. So, questions about organic gardening, problems with your vegetable plants last summer? Join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Kevin, you know, as during the news, I was thinking about these experiments and all the new things that gardeners are willing to try. And on our blog, by the way, we have a new blog. It's just go to wpr.org/Larry. to see what's there. And one of the stories you're going to see, along with a great photo, is an email I got from Paul Keene from Boulder Junction. And he had converted his swimming raft, he lives on a lake there, into a container garden. And it's a 10 by 10 foot swim raft. That he filled the raft with tomatoes and basil and squash. And he says, I can anchor it beyond the reach of the deer and the rabbits. Water's really readily available, and the ambient water temperatures provides a greenhouse quality for raising the plants. He can control the hours of sunshine by new anchor positioning. No need for added fertilizer, as the lake water is nutrient rich. And he sent a photo. He said the garden flourished, and he just had a beautiful harvest. And he kept the rabbits and the deer away because he set it out in the lake. What do you think of that?
Wow, that's really getting creative. You know, of course, we always have to think about unintended consequences, but. You know, if it's working, I guess one that I just caution is, you know, is there any unintended consequences to that, to the water? You know, because if that's all floating on that lake water, granted he's using lake water for fertilizing, which is fine, but, you know, is there any other things that might somehow be leached out of those plants and pots or whatever he's got in there into the water? And maybe that's something we need to at least think about, but... Wow, it's a creative way to. It's one way to beat the deer, right? It's like, okay, if you got to go swim for your lunch if you want some.
Well, he just pulls it in, I think.
Yeah,
I don't know
why.
He's got some waders or something. He just goes out in the water and harvests, and he does his watering, and his fertilizing is coming right out of the water itself. So it is a heck of an idea. You should go to our blog at wpr.org/Larry. And he's got a great picture there of the last year's Bounty, and man, it looks like he's got some really good plants and vegetables there growing right on his swim raft, 10 by 10 swim raft.
A new way of aquaculture, huh?
Yeah, I guess so, kind of. You can join in too, by the way, as you're listening in. Maybe you've got a great gardening idea or maybe a gardening question. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I want to go back to that display garden that you have at Spooner there. Part of the garden is a monarch way station. And maybe you could describe that and what plants you recommend for attracting monarchs and other pollinators.
Yeah, well, here too, I guess I got to really tip my gardening hat to our Master Gardener Volunteer organization, because they're the partner and a huge partner in that teaching and display garden, from the aspect of doing the creativity and coming up with all these, you know, ideas and the different themes that we have throughout the garden. So the pollinator sanctuary garden is basically a perennial garden that was kind of converted from our traditional perennial flowers and shrubs that you might have find lilies and hostas and hydrangeas and, you know, shrub roses and all that. But we converted it to be more pollinator friendly. And there's an organization called Monarch Watch, and they, of course, are big on promoting monarch habitat and pollinator habitat in general. So we went to those organizations to get references for the type of pollinator-friendly plants, both in the pollen and the nectar. And there's a lot of native plants, of course, that are well-suited for pollinator habitat. So they basically went off of those suggested plant lists and found ones that were appropriate for our climate, our zone, and they went and incorporated those into that landscaped design garden. And they've been thriving, and it's amazing, Larry, the year after we made that change. I mean, so we did this renovation in, you know, early spring, and throughout the season we got all these new plants in there. But the following year, we went through that season, and it was almost like night and day. The number of not only butterflies, but other pollinators, solitary bees and moths and whatnot that started to show up, honeybees included. So if you do it right, you do your research, you can do like they say, you know. But I would just suggest going to, you know, Xerces Society or this Monarch Watch.org, I believe, is the site, or just do an internet search on, you know, pollinator gardens, and you'll come up with all kinds of plant materials, you know, native and some non-native, and it depends on what your interests are and how crazy you want to get with that look. But it's done really well for us, and it's a kind of our centerpiece as people enter the garden. That's the first garden that they get to walk through, so it's worked real well for us.
Another Kevin in Spooner emailed to say that they have a no-mow lawn and encourage native woodland sedges, shrubs, milkweeds, and other pollinator plants to grow instead of grass, but they never get to harvest hazelnuts or service berries or strawberries or blueberries because of a surplus of chippies and squirrels. So they need an electric fence.
Yep. Yeah, like I said, there's all kinds of different approaches and philosophies to how we want to manage our landscapes. And, you know, I suppose up here in the northern part of the state, where you got a little bit more of that north woodsy environment, lawns and more of that urban kind of landscaping is not as prevalent, not that we don't enjoy it and certainly can't take advantage of that. But, sometimes we can do crazy things like that. I have done just that with a portion of my yard on one side of my house. It's all native plant materials, and I only mow the little walking path that goes in between it. Otherwise, everything else just I let go, just like it's a prairie. So, you know, you can do this, but it's going to look different. Your neighbors might think you're crazy. You might even get a nasty letter from the city that says you're in violation of some weed ordinance or something. But, yeah, it's just another way to do it. And I'm glad he mentioned that.
Yeah, and the whole business about trying to keep the squirrels and the chipmunks out of your hazelnuts, your service berries, and your strawberries and blueberries.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways, unfortunately. I mean, that's where, as people know, you've got to really think strategically, and it's almost like how do you outsmart some of those little guys? And that's where, you know, the more permanent physical barriers come into play, you know, the chicken wire fencing or the netting or any number of different techniques to just say, all right, you know, you stay out, but now that interferes with your gardening because you got to, you know, open up gates or have electric fence or uncover things every time you want to go, you know, harvest or manage the plants. So, yeah, sometimes it takes a lot of extra work, and that's just the way it is, I guess.
We had another person who wondered about that Seed to Kitchen Collaborative, if you could talk a little bit more about that program.
And again, as I mentioned earlier, I would suggest just going to their website. So if you typed in Seed to Kitchen Collaborative, you will find the website. It's hosted through UW-Madison Department of Horticulture, and they've got a number of different tabs that talk about the project. And what I really like about this whole collaborative, just like it says in the name, it's working not only with researchers, you know, some of the best plant breeders at universities in the upper Midwest and the, you know, the northern tier states, including UW-Madison, but there's really small backyard plant breeders and you know, different seed companies that are all being asked to kind of participate in this. But Julie has made a point, too, to get some of these plant varieties into home gardeners' backyards. So as a gardener, you can go to that website and actually click on a tab that says For Gardeners. And in that tab, you will see a little bit of, you know, information on, you know, how gardeners can participate and what are some of the observations and some of the data that you might provide them. Now, granted, it's not going to be as, you know, rigorous as what we can do here at the research station, but certainly you can grow, you know, a number of these plants, and they have their little protocol all, you know, spelled out on the website on how gardeners can participate. So, again, that's just seed2kitchen.horticulture.wisc.edu. But you can find it just with an internet search on Seed to Kitchen Collaborative, like UW-Madison, and it'll come up. I think the fact that it's participatory is really unique, because not only is she working with gardeners, but she's also working with market gardeners, and they're allowed to do the same thing, maybe a little bit more expansive, but there it's on their farms, under their growing conditions, and they're not collecting real detailed data, but it's still valuable in getting feedback that they can then report back to the breeders, and just collectively saying, hey, we're seeing a trend here. Not only do we have the research station data, but we've got all these other, you know, locations and people that are providing us input on the production. And then, of course, there's the chefs and the tastings that are incorporated into this project. So I really, you know, I'm happy to be part of this because it's something pretty unique.
Jane in central Wisconsin up next. Hi, Jane.
Yes, thank you. I'm calling about potatoes. I have a friend who kindly shares with me potatoes from his organic garden, but he always gives them with an apology that there might be some brown in the center. And he says it's not rot. He wonders if it's uneven watering, but it's kind of a hollow at the center of the potato that is coated in brown.
Hmm.
Do you have any idea?
Yes, I've seen this, and this is where, you know, I'd have to go and look it up. This is my standard answer. Well, I don't know, but I'll get back to you. I got to look it up. But there's a disorder called hollow heart that's common. You know, it's not something that I don't think is related to a disease as much as it is maybe the environment or the variety. But basically, I think the flesh grows so quickly that it creates this little void in the center of the potato. And once you've got that little hollow spot, you know, if there's any way for pathogens to get into the tuber, you know, that would cause, you know, rot and other, you know, factors that might make it unedible. But I think for the most part, it's just a physiological disorder. But again, I'd have to go and look up and see specifically how that happens and why. But I think it might be related to the actual cultivar, you know, so it might be predisposed to that condition. So switching to a different variety perhaps might avoid some of that. Or maybe it's the, you know, the growing conditions, too much water at one time, so things grow too quickly and you end up with those voids. But that would be my first guess.
Yeah, it's they call it brown heart sometimes, I think, or sugar center, I think I've heard. It's found pretty much anywhere. You grow potatoes. But I think you're right. I don't think it's not going to hurt to eat those.
Everybody's got a different tolerance when it comes to these kind of things. And if you feel like it just doesn't look right, you know, because we do eat with our eyes, and if there's a brown spot or a soft spot or something that just doesn't look right, you know, certainly, you know, that's the first order of, you know, defense, if you will, to protect yourself from getting sick. If you don't want to eat it, don't eat it. But, you know, like apple scab, a lot of times it's just superficial. You can peel that off, and the fruit underneath, the flesh underneath is perfectly fine. But, you know, I'd always err on the side of caution and say, well, if you don't want to eat those, I would just say, you know, you're not that desperate, I wouldn't think, that, you know, you can just throw it on the compost pile, I suppose, or dispose of it other ways.
Yeah. As we look at, and thanks again, Jane, for calling. Appreciate it. As you look back over the year, when it comes to vegetable diseases or vegetable issues in the northern part of the state up where you are, what were some of the most difficult things that you had to deal with?
Oh, boy. I mean, there's always those perennial pests that come up every year. And, you know, weather, as you know, Larry, you know, can play a big factor. You know, and on the insect side, I think, you know, because we were growing a fair amount of potatoes, you know, anytime you do that, you're just welcoming the Colorado potato beetle, you know, to come in. So I do know, because of the number of potatoes we grew, we did have those critters arrive, and we had to manage those. And again, that was all done organically with a BT product, you know, Bacillus thuringiensis, and I forget exactly what it was, the brand name, whatnot, but Colorado potato beetles we had showing up in our potatoes. We seem to have, because of that wet weather, I think that's pretty much statewide, more of the white molds and some of those leaf molds. We were able to kind of get by with some of our blights on our tomatoes. There's that early blight and septoria leaf spot that occur, you know, in our tomatoes. One thing that was of interest, though, is where those tomatoes were grown in our high tunnel or another low tunnel kind of structure, those diseases were much less, and they showed up much later in the season than the field-grown tomatoes that were literally just outside of those structures. So there's something about that environment that protects those plants from those spores. So, you know, that's another one. When it's wet and we got a lot of leaf wetness, those, you know, diseases tend to show up more than in the past. I'm just trying to think if there was anything else. I guess it would be more on the fungus side than the insect side as far as troubles.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, I over the year, I got a lot of photos from people with photos of plants. What's going on with this plant? And practically every case there was white mold.
Yeah.
of, you know, and who knows which white mold it was, but there were a lot of that this last year. Does that, I'm not sure if that carries over. I think it's, if you get a drier year the next year, it kind of goes away, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, right. I mean, and this is where, you know, it's all about, you know, that environment. You know, there's that three-legged stool we talk about in pest management, and you got to have a susceptible host or a plant that's going to be infected. You have to have the pathogen present, and then the third one is the proper environment. Mm-hmm. And that proper environment is what's, you know, somewhat we can control with some of our cultural practices, but, you know, Mother Nature can really help us or hurt us, and depends on the year. So a lot of these pathogens do have resting bodies and spores or sclerotia or whatever they do to reproduce. And once those are present, you know, they can stay in the soil for a number of years. And if our conditions are right, we can have the same problem occur. So, you know, that's where we got to look at strategies to minimize that advantage to the pathogen and try to outsmart it, you know, with some of our cultural practices or variety selection, and, you know, just trying to outsmart it as best we can. But at some point, it's going to get the upper hand, just like weeds in the garden. If you're, you know, if you're not mulching and you have bare soil, you're going to have weeds. So, you know, get the ground covered with mulch, and that will help minimize some of the weed pressure. So there's things we can do culturally, but it's always, that's what makes gardening so interesting. Every year is different.
And our last minute, John emailed to ask what he can do for his garden soil now to help for next spring.
Well, the fact that we probably have frozen or covered, is there snow on the ground down there yet? And I don't know where John
is. A little bit in parts, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, anytime we can amend our soil with organic matter, that's going to always be the easiest thing to do. And what does that look like and how do you do it? I'm a big fan of, again, keeping that soil covered. And in the fall of the year, you know, if you've got all your plant materials pulled up and you have areas where you can, especially in annual crops like, you know, vegetables, you know, for instance, or even around our perennials, it never hurts to continue to make sure we got adequate mulch around the base of the plants or just on bare soil, because that is going to protect the soil and keep it from, you know, erosion or any of those other things that might physically happen to it. But it also will, over time, you know, provide organic matter that worms and other things will incorporate into the soil. So this time of year, you know, covering things with a good layer of leaf mulch if you can. Doing a soil test if your soil is not frozen hard. Get that taken care of.
And there you go. Hey, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being with us today. Appreciate it. Kevin Chesso works out of the Spooner area, where he works with Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He's the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Thanks to have him. Thanks for him being with us today. Thanks for listening. Monday, we'll talk with our physical therapists on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.